This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Just a young gun with a quick fuse. I was uptight, wanna let loose. I was dreaming.
All right, we have to call Newsham here. Helps when I kill the music.
We have Brent speaking.
Joining us from someplace on the planet, we know that much, is the one and only Grant Newsham. Grant, good evening. How are you? Good morning.
Fine, thanks.
Where are you?
I actually happen to be in Canberra, Australia.
How is that? I've never been to Canberra.
Oh, nice.
Is it nice?
Yeah, it is. It's kind of, I think Australians consider it really boring, but it's nice. It's in the countryside, and it's a lot of greenery. There's a big lake in the middle, but it's a quiet place. So, but you know, the Australians, if you tell them you're going to Canberra, it's not like anybody says, "Oh, that's great." But it's more like, "Why are you going?" is the question. But I like it.
What's the highlight of going to Australia, if I might ask?
Oh, boy.
There you go. Tough questions. You know, it's a tough radio show when you get that one.
It's a tough one. You know, I don't, you know, because everyone likes Australia, but I'm trying to think what the highlight is. It's the Sydney Opera House is probably something that you remember once you see it.
Right. All right. So we get past that. Then what? Then what do we do?
In terms of then what the highlight is, I don't know. There's a lot of ocean. Kangaroos. I saw a kangaroo this evening.
There's a lot of desert too, yes?
Oh, it's a big, yeah. It makes Arizona look kind of modest, I think. But yeah, a good chunk of the country is deserty. Yeah, you know, it's just like a bunch of people who look like Americans but don't talk like Americans. But one thing I've noticed is the female Australian accent, I'm convinced that it could penetrate lead. Boy, it makes like a Brooklyn accent sound nice. I'm not making this up. I think it does. Like a physicist could figure it out that, you know, it could penetrate anything. And I just had to throw that out.
For those of you, Grant writes for a number of publications on the subject of Pacific Rim security, retired Marine colonel, and made kind of a living working with the Japanese in the Pacific while he was on active duty. And so he's gracious enough to come on and has made us extremely smart. And he coined the phrase, for me anyway, cautiously pessimistic, which I love. And it proves to be right on the money. Before we talk about the Pacific, any thoughts on the Russians? And evidently we're getting ready to use gas in Syria again, which I might say if you're going to do it, do it on the front end. Don't conduct a siege like the siege of Petersburg in the Civil War. You know, kill tens of thousands of people, and then at the end say, yeah, let's use gas, and then we'll get this thing over with. You know, do it on the front end, a lot less loss of life, and then be done with it in terms of if you're going to butcher people. Any thoughts on the Russians and their behavior in either the Middle East or the Eastern or Eastern Europe?
Well, you know, it... Mr. Putin has played a bad hand really well. The country's got immense economic problems, social problems. You know, people still drink half their body weight in alcohol every few days. You know, it can't produce anything that anybody wants to buy except for oil and gas. Yeah. Yet he has managed to get himself and his country taken really seriously in the way that really an aggressive sort of pest does, and he's played it very well. He's reestablished himself in the Middle East, reestablished Russia, where it hadn't been there for 30, 40 years. And that really, Mr. Obama and his team deserve full credit for that. And one recalls that the Obama administration was being too clever by half, and figures that, well, by letting the Russians into Syria and get involved there, that it would put them in a quagmire. Not quite. It's gotten them back in the Middle East. It's gotten them taken really seriously, and they were, you know, they almost seem to feel free now. They're to do whatever they want, up to a point. But they've thrown their weight around nicely. I think where you really have to watch out is the, say, Western Europe, the Baltic states in particular, where there's a very active Russian political warfare campaign going on, saying that effectively that Russia deserves parts of the Baltic states. And it's having a lot of success. It is demoralizing people. They're subverting other countries in Eastern Europe. And in East Asia, not so much of, of an issue from my perspective. They're not going to give Japan back the territories that they took after World War II, no matter how much Japan's prime minister would like. But is it, and I think they probably do wake up, or Mr. Putin wakes up every morning and wonders if the Chinese have built five cities like Shenzhen in on the Russian side of the border in Siberia, that is pretty empty and underpopulated. But I could see the Russians, as say, have managed to make a real nuisance of themselves, and nobody has actually been able to do a whole lot about it on the U.S. side, although the Trump administration has been far sterner and stricter towards Russia than the Obama administration was.
The I want to one other thing I saw over the weekend that I thought was that caught my eye, that broke squelch for me, and that is this comments about one, and I'm going to link two separate thoughts. One was about cyber war. That America is slow to the war that's being conducted against us. Why we're slow, not exactly sure. Some of it had to do with the aforementioned Obama administration and the regulations they put on Americans' operations in cyber world. But the essence was the war has already started. You deciding that you're not sure that if really it's a war and what steps you should take, I mean, you're late to the party. You better get with it because, you know, it's being brought to you on a daily basis. So that was one. Next article I saw was, I don't know if this guy was a philosopher. Exactly. What is that? That's an unemployed teacher, I think. I don't know, or he was a artificial intelligence guy or some combination of the two. But he essentially said this. A few years ago, I would have said the greatest threat to the planet is, and I can't even remember what he said, nuclear weapons. Now what I would tell you is it is artificial intelligence, right, controlling systems and nefarious actors by cyber war taking over that artificial intelligence and then dictating how the artificial intelligence controls, you know, some major aspect or some major part of our lives. I'm curious about your thoughts about cyber warfare. Are we late to the party? And when you combine cyber warfare with artificial intelligence and the things that artificial intelligence is beginning to control, it's a pretty little interesting topic of discussion.
The artificial intelligence part, you know, I'm not sure I'm really smart enough to comment on it, other than to sort of echo what you've just said, that it's just using a little imagination, even for the history major like me, that it is concerning as to how it can be misused, because it certainly has some uses, some of them positive, and obviously criminal minds or those people inclined that way get involved with it. And one can imagine there's a lot of trouble it can cause. But as I say, it's not really my thing, but it obviously is sort of potentially a huge problem. I think one area that I've read about is it can make it a lot harder to actually hide Navy ships and submarines out in the big ocean. And that's obviously a big issue. But I do see it as a concern. I remember seeing that in a movie when I was very little, a Space Oddity. Space Odyssey, I forget what the year was.
2001.
Oh, was that it? Okay. Yep. But I remember being bored senseless because I sort of like Davy Crockett movies. But I remember the idea of a machine taking over, you know, being able to kind of think for itself and take over was something that was considered, you know, really far-fetched or just science fiction, something that would never happen in our lifetimes. And yet it has, and probably then some, is how I would put it. I imagine that what was depicted in the movie is kind of primitive compared to what's going today. Regarding the cyber warfare issue, boy, you know, I hope we're not late, but I have a feeling that we might be. You know, one certainly hopes that we're doing more than everyone else is and just not telling anybody and able to keep it secret, or that we're ready to do it. You know, that's, you know, one of these things I think a lot of Americans sort of get by with is hoping that there's smart people somewhere working on this stuff so that when the need really comes, we can take care of ourselves. One wonders, you know, you look at how, you know, we have not, the U.S. government apparently has not responded to serious criminal activity put up by the North Koreans, the Russians said to be involved, the Chinese as well. Say the Sony hacks, for instance, the WannaCry sort of cyber extortion schemes. It doesn't appear that that we've done anything to really find the people who did it and really hurt them, you know, make them wish they hadn't done it and make sure that others don't do that sort of things. The Chinese hacked the OPM, Office of Personnel Management Records, a few years ago and stole like 21 million records. And apparently anyone who's ever filled out a sort of a government application form like the SF-187 or such like, the Chinese appear to have it, and it doesn't. And the Obama administration apparently did nothing in response to that. So, you know, you have your doubts as to how willing the U.S. government has been to go after the people who do these kinds of things, both government and private. And like a lot of things, if you don't nip it in the bud, when you find that you have no choice but to go after it, it's a lot harder to do.
Yeah, you might go looking for the bud, and you find out the bud's not there anymore. What happened? I don't want to destroy your thesis here, but I'm going to.
Okay.
At the rate we keep secrets, if we were working on this, do you think we wouldn't know about it? Do you think that, yeah, but those guys can really keep secrets well. The only people that keep secrets in the DOD is Delta Force, okay? The fact that you don't know shit about us killing between 200 and 500 Russians, right, is because the SEALs weren't involved in it, okay?
That's a good point, yes.
Right, but Delta Force is involved in it, and they don't say anything. They're the only people that keep secrets. So unless our cyber war has been kicked to Delta, then I think we're late. My conclusion, therefore, would be we're late to the party.
Yeah, it could be. I'm not entirely convinced. Maybe we're just not letting the SEALs get involved in it, but they can write books about it. But
exactly.
You know, we do some things, and one recalls the Stuxnet virus, their cyber offensive used against the Iranian nuclear program, and that stayed secret for a good long while, and it kind of got revealed, I don't know, inadvertently, but I think that, you know, can maybe give you a little confidence that somebody somewhere is doing some good work. And is ready to, you know, maybe even doing things, but it certainly, hopefully, is ready to pull the trigger when the time comes. And so I'd like to think that, you know, what the computer people are doing is I think we don't. I think a lot of it isn't getting revealed, which is always a good thing. You know, I hope that's the case. But like you, we do get kind of used to everything getting leaked. But maybe there's a lot of things that don't in this area. Once again, Stuxnet comes to mind. You know, and I believe the Israelis are doing all sorts of things, and you know, that doesn't leak, but it is the Israelis, of course. I'd like to think we have some ability to
maybe
sort of restrain ourselves.
Maybe we decide we're a supplier to the Mossad's development, and I'm okay with that because the Mossad will keep it a secret. You'll find out.
You're currently a joint venture with the Israelis, so
I like that.
I think that you know, maybe a 50% chance. 50% chance. I'm not quite as pessimistic as you are, though. I can understand.
You've taught me cautiously pessimistic.
Well, NFL season's starting, so I'm optimistic the Redskins have it in the bag. So.
Really?
For a week at least.
My friends and I, we've taken to, over the course of the last couple of years, I think like a lot of people, to not watching the NFL, and we all grew up and we enjoy the NFL, but we don't watch it anymore because of the whole national anthem controversy. And then over the weekend, and I tweeted about this. There was a report from ESPN saying that the NFL will not have any kind of national anthem policy in place for the 2018 season. And I went back and did a little bit of satire. I'll recall a little bit of satire I did on the show. After the end of the 2017 season, the owners get together, and the consistent, you know, voices, hey, we've got to solve this with our players, okay? We cannot have the President of the United States bashing us. We cannot have this be the marquee issue that comes up when we put our product out there. This is killing us. And everybody nods their head, right. Okay, Goodell, you've got to solve this. Well, you've already kicked $90 million to a social activism fund for players. What did we get for that? Nothing? Because this thing's still killing us. Okay, I got it. Guys, you have my word. By the time 2018 starts, we will have this thing in the can. There'll be a policy. We'll be able to do what we do, which is entertain. And the first Colin Kaepernick commercials, Nike, blah, 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 blah. And now we don't have a policy. It's the stupidest thing in the world that an organization as great as the NFL is, it has the money and the marketing power that they cannot find a way to respect the flag and also provide a forum and a venue for their players to convey their concern over social issues. It blows my mind that they can't do both, that they can't figure it out, and their viewership continues to take a hit, their revenue continues to take a hit. It's just like, to me, Goodell is a stumbling fool. And whether you talk about the Ray Rice when he knocked his girlfriend out and the NFL doesn't react to it, in spite of having seen the video, and now you watch this and you're like, dude, you guys are idiots. Lucky that thing's a cash cow and you can just spend your way to solutions, because if there was any pressure applied to your business, you would be out of business. So, anyway, just a thought if you care to comment on the National Football League. I don't know if you care to. But.
Oh, boy. If the Redskins win, I'm happy. But, yeah, I know what you mean. It's you'd think for all the money at stake and being thrown around and the $40 million or so that Roger Goodell earns every year, somebody would have to produce. Yet, you know, they don't. And, you know, I think it is funny how the reputation or just interest in the league is not what it was just a couple of years ago. And one wonders what the effect will be over time. Yeah, we'll see. It'd be an interesting Harvard Business School case study, I should imagine.
There you go. I'm seeking to be a part of. I just curiosity. Look, there's all this at stake. We can't sit down with our players and find middle ground here. Come on, we have to. And the players know it. because, you know, I think what's curing a lot of players is they're watching guys be economically impacted as they go to, you know, get contracts and things like this. And it's, look, I respect if that's how you feel, that's fine. But when I bring you to my team, I'm going to have to deal with to hire you. And you better be a top line player if I'm going to do that. That's going to win us the Super Bowl. Because if you're not that guy, the juice isn't worth the squeeze. Sorry about that. So continue your social activism. Go get them. But if this is a business decision for us too, and bringing you in just doesn't make sense for us. And so I you would think in the midst of all of that, the players who are being cured by the economics of it, and it's not retribution. It's just, look, it's a business decision. Okay. I'm going to get impacted by season tickets, advertising revenues. I'm going to have veterans organizations. I'm going to have all this shit go on in my community. You don't justify that. Okay. So it just blows me away that they can't get their hands around it. All right. Let's transition to parades, to other things of substance. North Korea holds a parade. No intercontinental ballistic missiles. Is this the proverbial putting lipstick on a pig? Nothing to see here. Everybody keep moving. No ICBMs. Let's be friends. What's going on?
That's what it is. I wouldn't think this has any significance at all. It's superficial. And hopefully nobody believes that this indicates a change of heart on the part of the North Korean regime. I say not at all. It'll be forgotten about within probably 12 hours. I don't think anyone will even remember the whole thing. We'll be back to fretting over how this new denuclearization is going to take place. But the parade itself is no significance to it. I mean, the fact that the ICBMs were not on display, and I gather some of the usual sort of anti-American propaganda wasn't on display either. But once again, it's, you know, if anyone thinks it is, then have them explain why it is significant. You know, what is the next move that is going to come from North Korea? But if the idea is that, well, America will offer up a concession based on this, then I'd say forget about it.
Forget about it?
If I was from Brooklyn.
I was going to say you didn't say that right, but I'm picking up what you're putting down. Okay, so the cosmetics. What was the 70th anniversary of what, the founding of the North Korean state, or what were they commemorating?
I think that was it. Notable that President Xi didn't come. I think there's a little bit of significance there. Say a little bit. They still sent somebody pretty high up in the Chinese Communist Party stratosphere. But it was, I think it was just the, say, 70th anniversary of the founding. But once again, you know, people are so desperate to find something positive or to just read the tea leaves instead of just, you know, sticking for like what a farmer would require, show me something substantial on the North Korean part. And I don't see that. And I, as importantly, I don't see the Trump administration falling for this at all. To me, the bigger concerns that are coming out of all of this is that we just might end up with a lot of friction or ill will, resentment between us and the South Koreans.
Right.
I think it's been informative to see the extent to which South Korea's President Moon and his advisors in particular represent that slice of South Korean society that sees America as the problem and that thinks that that they can get back together with North Korea if the South is nice enough, is just understanding enough, and offers enough to North Korea. And that it's there's a belief on the U.S. side that I think is shaped by the Korean War experience when America saved South Korea. And we often tend to think of all the South Koreans as being, you know, forever joined with us and thinking like us, but that hasn't been the case for an awful long time. But now this is like having a South Korean Jimmy Carter take over as president. But you're seeing it on display when it all ends, and either America gives up on any hope with North Korea. If South Korea does not come along with us and continues to this appeasement policy, I think we could have some problems in that relationship. And that will be a very interesting thing to see.
Interesting. Talk about the position that President Moon finds himself in. And let's just say everybody's got a role. You know, the role of the United States is to be the demanding, world power that's concerned with security in the Pacific. The role of of China is to be the skeptical brother. The role of the South Koreans are the I don't want to say placating, but the consistently positive spinning cousin that shows up at the party. Talk to me about President Moon and his the dilemma that he finds himself in. And then how does this impact him politically? What do you hear relative to the sentiment about the Korean people? Because I think everybody, you know, I saw Barack Obama now making speech, and whenever I see Barack Obama, the Coke song, right, the Coke song plays in my head. I'd like to buy the world a Coke, and then we're all holding hands, right? But I think the Swedes just went to the polls over the weekends, and they moved to the right. They rejected that we want to be a nation with open borders and we want to be transformed by having a large Islamic population. They don't want that. They don't want that to happen to Sweden. They're not ready for that. And it's not being managed well, and they're concerned. They're registering their concern at the ballot box. And people want to say, well, that's racism. No, it's not. We're Swedish people. This is the culture I live in, right? You're raising the immigration numbers of people that don't want to be Swedish. They do want to come here though and live and establish their own culture here in our culture. Is that what we want? Because that's what we've seen around the rest of Europe. So we see these things. President Moon is in a pretty unique position. Talk to us about what he's trying to do and the reality that confronts him on this five-sided triangle that he plays.
With Moon, to me, he represents, and as I use the Jimmy Carter comparison, and we remember Carter, maybe not everyone does, but Jimmy Carter represented a school of thought which had existed since before the end of World War II, actually. And the idea was that Soviet behavior was aggressive and threatening because the Russians felt threatened by the Americans, by the West. And as a result, the theory was that if we give the Soviets no reason to be afraid, then they will change their behavior accordingly. It was the thinking. It was an academic theory that academics believed, politicians believed it, the parts of the chattering class believed it. So when Carter came in, he just applied really a sort of quite an established sort of idea and sort of philosophy to U.S. foreign policy, which was different than all his predecessors. And it was a good theory. It was, he thought, and everyone, his people thought it, and it was supposed to work. It didn't work. And Moon reflects that. It is a thought out, conscious belief that the problems with North Korea, the Korean War, in fact, can be ended simply by the South, which is a stronger, more successful country, just showing a little more understanding. And that's what this reflects. And you throw in a degree of resentment that the Americans are the ones who have seen to or believed to have kept the two Koreas, these fraternal Korea brotherhood apart. So throw that into the mix. So mood is just applying, as I say, a theory, an idea. And it's not paying off for him yet. And it's obviously it's been tried a few times before in Korea, at least twice by previous regimes that paid hundreds of millions of dollars to the North, hoping to get better behavior, and that didn't work. So Moon's just the latest guy to try this. And he does not, of course, reflect all of South Korean society, but he does reflect a sizable chunk of it. What is going to be very interesting with him is that the South Korean economy is in terrible shape. You never read much about it just because it's not a topic in the right. Western media. But it's in terrible shape. And there's a generational aspect to all of this, particularly younger people who cannot get jobs. And they're a lot less interested in sending money up to North Korea and giving them stuff that South Koreans ought to have. And Moon's popularity, it's still reasonably high. But like a lot of things, I think as he has less and less success, and as the economy is worse and worse and worse, and it's already, as I say, it is terrible, that I think we're going to see him become pretty unpopular. And once a president becomes unpopular, most of these guys have some some sort of corruption in their past, that I think his predecessor, Ms. Park's supporters, just may go after Moon the way, should they ever get back in power.
So you know what? It's interesting you say that, Grant, because you know what I was thinking of this morning. The economy continues to like be incredible, right? And I thought the thought went through my head: what would Donald Trump's fate be if the economy was in the tank? And you're drawing a parallel with President Moon. But I mean, think about it. Let's just say the economy just was struggling along and was what it was under for most of President Obama's 8 years. Just it can't get going. You know, GDP at 2% or under. You know, just and the normal nonsense. I don't think Mr. Trump's numbers would be, you know, close to 50% in terms of approval rating, where he tends to hover between 45 and 50. I don't think he'd be close to that. And it'd be a much different political landscape in the country, which is obviously what President Moon's encountering in South Korea.
All right, I think you're right. I think Mr. Trump might even be gone by now if that was the case. And it plays out, it'll play out with Moon as well, I think, eventually. But moving along, you had mentioned the idea that everybody in this drama plays a certain part. And with the Chinese and the South Koreans and us each playing a role, but we each, I think, have different objectives, which is, so it makes it, that's something to keep in mind. The Chinese do not want a resolution of the kind we want. They want North Korea to keep being an irritant and a distraction. They don't want a unified Korea. Moon does want a unified Korea, but he's willing to do anything to get it, which means he's not likely to get it because the North isn't going to cooperate. And then the Americans.
How could I mean the whole subject of reunification to me is it's as crazy as I've ever heard. I mean, like, how do you unify something that's so opposed to itself? And I'll quote the great emancipator Abraham Lincoln: "A house divided against itself cannot stand." How about that, Nathan?
Well, if you get rid of the Americans, everything will be all right.
Somewhere Jimmy Carter is clapping right now. Yes.
Yeah.
Newsom got it.
But if the, how would you put it, Mr. Trump, I think, is, and we've talked about this before, but he kind of got backed into a corner when President Moon sprung this charm of, what do you call it, this love fest or love strategy towards North Korea at the time of the Winter Olympics. And that put, although the Americans have been more successful than ever at putting pressure on North Korea and building sort of a wide-ranging pressure on the North Koreans, but So Mr. Trump was in a position, whereas if he didn't go along with this, he would be accused of not giving peace a chance. But if he went along with it, he would be accused of being naive and an appeaser and that sort of thing. So this has really delayed the whole thing by at least a year. Probably it will be longer. But you have just diverging objectives and in every party involved here. And I don't see how I think we'll be back to square one before too long.
Pretty amazing. Okay, let me cover some more ground with you. The Chinese warn the Brits, stay out of the South China Sea. More of the same? Any significance, anything to see here?
I think there is actually. I was actually on that British ship a couple of weeks earlier.
Really?
They were kind enough to let me come and visit when it was in Japan. I think there is some significance here, but it's not so much that the British went through the South China Sea, which was very interesting. It was nice to see them do that, and it is a sign that Britain does have a sort of not just an interest, but is taking sides in this Chinese effort to dominate and seize control of most of East Asia. Britain, of course, can't really apply any meaningful military pressure in Asia, and probably in Europe it's hard pressed as well, the way it's reduced its military. Which is a shame, but no. In Asia it's even less likely.
Grant, it is what it is, and the folly of unilaterally disarming is a history lesson. If you want to go down that road, then you will get what you will get. But other nations that have done that have at some point regretted the very fact that they did. So
yeah, I think they will too if they're not already. This was the HMS Albion that went through the South China Sea. It's an amphibious ship.
Oh.
And it's the only amphibious ship the Royal Navy has. You know. If you're waiting for the punchline, there isn't one.
Come on.
I'm not making this up. They had another one, which was like an LHA called the HMS Ocean, and they sold it to the Brazilians about 6 months ago or so.
Nice.
So this is their amphibious ship. It would be like if the U.S. Navy had, say, the USS Denver. That was it. you can see just how difficult a position the Royal Navy's in. Britain can't really exert much influence in Asia militarily, but it does have political significance and importance when Britain decides whose side it's on. And it does still have some very useful resources that we want available to us and vice versa. So it did take some nerve for them to sort of irritate the Chinese. But once again, one has to keep in mind Britain's overall capabilities. But one thing that was interesting that happened, actually, that for an Asian defense thing, was that while the British were in Japan, they brought with them a Royal Marine detachment of about 120 Royal Marines, and they were all set to do a small landing exercise with the Japanese new amphibious unit and with the Japanese Navy involved in it. And they're going to do it on a beach not too far from Mount Fuji at a place called Numazu. But so think of it, you were going to have British Marines doing a landing with the Japanese in Japan. And this was not just thought impossible 5 years ago. It was thought insane, the idea that this could happen. This was going to be the first time that I'm aware of, or anyone else's, that foreign ground troops were going to train in Japan who were not Americans. And the Japanese reaction to all of this, say public and political, was nothing. Nobody raised a peep, and nobody cared. But it's a good sign of just how Prime Minister Abe has brought Japan back to the center militarily, or has done a good job of it. So the way I look at, you know, in this thing, I tend to be kind of an optimist. If you can,
holy smokes, let me steady myself. Go ahead.
Well, it's also like 1:48 in the morning here, so I could be drunk.
All right. We'll accept that caveat.
Okay, but this is, you know, to have, as I say, this was really something. And it shows what's doable. And now what, if, you know, for, to bring other foreign troops in, to have the Japanese do more. If you just turn it over to the captains and the majors, you'll get some real progress if our ruling class is smart enough to do that. But that was significant. And I was in line to actually watch the landing, but it got weathered out by a typhoon that came along. And the sea state was just too dangerous. The British concurred that the waves were too high. It wasn't just the Japanese wanting to back out, but it was too dangerous. But that was something that, as I say, got almost zero notice in any of the press, but was a much more significant thing. So I thought the Royal Marines coming along was actually as important as the ship sailing through the South China Sea on the way back.
Wow. No, that's big stuff. And arguably, when you do all that planning and the coordination, announcing it to the public, the least significant piece of it is the physical event itself.
I think so. Yeah.
Because you can practice the weeks before that and all that, and you can, you know, you go there and you make contact with them, you work together, you communicate, you do all that stuff. And if the game gets rained out, so be it. But all those other exercises got muscled, and it lays the groundwork to do it again another time. But as you said, I mean, those are steps that the Japanese, and I hope Germany's paying attention. Those are steps that the Japanese those steps were thought impossible. What, 5 years ago, less?
Yeah, certainly 5, and even a couple years ago, if not a year ago, I'd say maybe 2 months ago, but. Yeah, and you just do more and more of this. You know, it'd be nice if the Royal Marines brought out, puts a couple of liaison officers with the Japanese, so they could, some of that would rub off on Japan's new amphibious force. But also there's a political significance, a psychological significance, both on the Japanese, on the British, the Americans, but also on the Chinese. When Britain is making the effort to send troops out to Japan, it's implicitly saying whose side it's on. And while Britain can't do a whole lot in Asia, it can apply economic pressure, its political support for what the U.S. and really the civilized world is trying to do to uphold law is that's important. So say there's a sort of an outsized significance to what just happened in Japan and on the HMS Albion, their one ship.
their amphibious task force, one man gang. So the fact that the Chinese made this pointed effort relative to the Albion, do you think that is no coincidence based on what it did in Japan? That the Chinese were looking to make sure that they registered their disapproval, or do you think it was just more of the same based on the FON ops that have gone on in the South China Sea?
I think it was probably the latter, because when the Australians go through the same area, they get the same treatment. The French had the same experience, and even the Americans, the Chinese do interfere. So that's how I would look at it. It was... had just had more to do with the fact they were in South China Sea.
Here's an email. Mac, it seems like we're intercepting Russian bombers off the coast of Alaska. I know we used to do this during the Cold War. Is this anything that breaks squelch? I'd be curious Grant's thoughts. Grant, does that break squelch?
Yeah, I think it does, in the sense that it's more evidence of Mr. Putin playing his hand very aggressively. And where I think it's not so much a fear that he's going to slip a plane through to Anchorage and destroy the place, but it's more, I think, a reflection of my cocksuredness that is going to play out, I would suspect, in, unfortunately, in Eastern Europe, in that area. That's where I would have some of the biggest concerns. Is Russia grabbing something, either once again in the Baltic states or even farther south, where they were behind an attempted coup in Montenegro not long ago. Moldova is apparently in the crosshairs as well. But so I think as a reflection of almost criminal intent, that's how I would tend to look at it. That's going to play out somewhere else.
Okay. I haven't asked you to do this in a while, but I will ask you to do this today. Get your crystal ball out, and what is the next step in this dance between North Korea, South Korea, Japan, China, and the United States?
I think that the within a matter of months, I think there's going to be a very serious sort of, I don't know if it's a break, but serious problem between the Americans and the South Koreans. I think America will have, quote, had enough, and South Korea will want to continue sort of this bribery appeasement strategy towards North Korea, and somebody that is going to have to get resolved one way or the other. One can imagine that if the South Koreans stick to their position too strong, that the Americans, and particularly Mr. Trump, might kind of do what Donald Rumsfeld did when the South Koreans were too difficult, was say, okay, take care of yourselves. And that is where I would see the something very interesting to watch, is how does the U.S.-South Korean relationship play out over, say, the next three to four months. I don't think the Chinese are going to do anything different than they have been doing, and I'm wondering if we may not see the Americans put some real sanctions on Chinese financial institutions, the big banks like People's Bank of China. As in the administration, they know exactly what the Chinese are doing to support the North Koreans financially, and they're not enforcing any sanctions at all, hardly. Mr. Trump has even mentioned this. So I wonder if the Americans are going to hammer the Chinese on this. It wouldn't surprise me if they did. But I don't see the North Koreans doing anything all that interesting that would get one's attention that they might be serious. So I think the bigger, the more interesting things to watch will be the U.S. and South Korean relationship, and then what the Americans try to do to the Chinese, sanctions-wise, to try and get them to be a little more helpful. But I think that we will not see denuclearization. And despite, I think, North Koreans trying to offer up some things that that only a moron would think were genuine. So that's sort of my guess. And, you know, I don't know, look out a year and, some things do depend on the U.S. domestic political situation. Because one could imagine if the midterm elections turn out a certain way, we could just, it could be a hellhole in Washington with such distraction that maybe a thing like South Korea, like the Korean problem, just like everything else, kind of gets pushed to the side in this internal fighting between the Republicans and the Democrats, and the Democrats try doing their best, as they've done really since 30 seconds after the election results, trying to destroy the president. But we've got bigger problems to face.
You have to look on the upside of that. Somewhere in Moscow, some major lieutenant colonel captain keeps getting called in, and his award for that operation keeps getting upgraded. We never in a million years thought that stupid-ass dossier, right, that we contributed to, and the stuff we did on the extreme fringe of the election in an ecosystem, in a cyber ecosystem that's ginormous, would have this kind of that would reverberate like this through the American media and the political infrastructure. Here's your seventh order of the Soviet Union. That guy is just like, he completely, and again, and then what he probably said was, I told you, if we simply unleash them against themselves, there is huge money behind, in this quarrel. There's media people that are lined up in it. All we have to do is provide the fodder for the discussion, and they will burn it down. You're right. Here's an eighth order of Lenin, by the way. That guy is
a perpetual motion machine this guy created. One thing I'll throw in, this may be of interest, is the dossier that, you know, I used to do this kind of work, like a lot of it for a long time. And when I remember when the dossier first came out, I remember taking a look at it, and I think it took 5 minutes to have a distinct feeling that this was fabricated. And why do I say that? Because I had seen things offered up by this. Oddly enough, one of them by a former MI6 guy who was operating where I was working and was trying to flog this stuff, flog his work to companies like ours. But the whole thing read like fabricated intelligence. And I suspect, actually, that the British guy who put it together, I think he didn't think it was ever going to really see the light of day. It would just circulate like below the surface. Because you'll notice that what he's saying in court in London, where some of the oligarchs that he defamed have put him on trial, is very different than what he was telling the FBI and everybody else. Because when a Russian oligarch brings you to court, you're probably going to say one thing and be very careful, because you're going to wind up dead if you don't tell something like the truth.
They don't. Do they administer an oath to that, or do they need to? Like, you better say the right thing, because
I think it's implied. But also, it was something, if you saw how much they got paid for this, that it's the kind of stuff a certain type of researcher fabricates, particularly for people who are, one, paying a lot of money, and two, who are going to be impressed by things like source A said this, source B said that, you know, this whiff of the clandestine world. But I'd say it took 5 minutes to get a real feeling that it was fabricated. But once again, whoever did it is going to get, you know, orders of whatever, the Soviet Union or whatever they've got today, right. And a dasha, or probably dashas in every time zone in Russia. But I think that is going to have a lot of effect, though, on what happens to U.S. foreign policy around the world. I noticed that Adam Smith, it's the Democrats take over, he's going to be prominent in the, I think, Defense Committee in Congress. He's calling, I think it was September 5th, he called for the Americans to announce that they and us and the Chinese can coexist. So one can imagine us going back to what we used to be doing, and if we do, I don't know that the game's over, but will be headed towards a quick finish. I'm back to the normal pessimism.
All right, final question. The trade surplus with China was just announced, and it wasn't good news for our economy. The only person it was good news for, I think, was the president. The Chinese, I'm sure, looked at it and winced when they saw it, like, here we go again. Your thoughts on where that little piece of your thoughts of something you sent me an email entitled "Ruh-roh, checking on my prepper supplies." Where does that take us, that little data point, in terms of the not insignificant growth of the trade deficit with China?
I think we're going to keep the pressure on. I think there's going to be tariffs applied on a lot more of the stuff that's coming, the Chinese are sending our way, at a minimum. there's going to be more restrictions on Chinese investment in the U.S. Than there ever have been. That's obviously in the works. But the trade surplus and the tariffs in particular, they one thing to keep in mind is that and this is the Trump administration understands it, but it's not widely understood, is the extent to which the Chinese government, Chinese Communist Party, depends on foreign exchange. It's not often recognized that the Chinese currency is not really convertible, and it resembles Confederate money back in the days of the Confederate States of America, where you could print Confederate money, and to the extent people in the Confederacy wanted to use it and could buy stuff with it, that was okay. But if you wanted to buy Enfield rifles from the British, you needed to pay in U.S. greenbacks, and you had to get those greenbacks somewhere. And that is the Chinese government's dilemma, is it has to get foreign exchange, either from Western companies or companies investing in China, governments contributing money to them, or Chinese companies earning it somehow. And when they earn it, they actually have to give it back to the government, basically. And so if you can reduce the amount of foreign exchange that the Chinese government has, it restricts their ability to fund all these things they're funding, particularly overseas. And it also reduces public confidence in the Chinese Communist Party and its ability to run the economy. So that's one of the things the tariffs do. If you can put a limit on reduce the amount of exports from China, it reduces their amount of foreign currency holding, which gives the Chinese Communist Party what I think in Brooklyn used to be called a case of the shorts. So there is actually a logic to this, more than just making stuff expensive. It's to try and choke off or close off, reduce the amount of foreign, the amount of effectively Yankee greenbacks available to the Chinese Communist Party. But I think this is not going to, there's not going to be a resolution reached on this anytime soon. And when Chinese teams come to America to negotiate, there's no possible way they're going to resolve this unless Mr. Trump feels that he just wants to declare victory. And I don't think that's likely. So I see this continuing probably for at least the rest of Mr. Trump's term or terms. And even if I think another side takes over, they may continue something similar.
Well, they ought to, my opinion. They ought to. I think the workers and the American economy cannot continue to get fleeced by the Chinese. You made a comment a few weeks ago that said, yeah, I think that you know, the United States actually stood up on its hind legs, and everybody around looked and went, oh my God, look at that. And so long overdue. All right, sir, first of all, what's the next thing you're going to write, and where are we going to find it?
I actually wrote something that just appeared today about in one of the Japanese Sankei Shimbun's English outlet about the British Marines. I think another thing coming out about the Vostok 2018 exercise the Russians are doing this week.
Yes.
That should be in Asia Times tomorrow, I think. I'm looking at it from the Japanese perspective. I think those are in the works, or will be out very shortly. And then the next thing, I'm not sure. Maybe a follow up to the earlier article about the Chinese influence in the American territories in the Pacific, Guam, Saipan, and that other one. I can't think of it. Guam, CNMI, and American Samoa, and in Micronesia, Palau, and Marshall Islands. But so I laid out what the Chinese have been doing. That was in an Asia Times piece the other day. And the second half is what the Americans should do about it. That's the part where I'm trying to be constructive.
But
I think that's what's next.
Attaboy. The a final email, and then I'll let you go. Give me a 30-second answer. Do you believe the person who wrote the New York Times, the anonymous New York Times op-ed piece, is a national security threat? And do you think they ought to resign? I think the fact that they ought to resign is a no-brainer. Do you think they're a national security threat?
Yeah, I tend to think so. I think if one will do something that dishonest, that there's really kind of no limit. You can pretty one rationalize from one thing to another.
Right.
Yeah, I would tend to I would think so. There's, you know, a certain level of integrity in a job like that, and I think this is doesn't display it. It is also amusing that these people consider themselves the resistance.
Right.
If you want to talk about a resistance, look at the group that killed Heydrich in Czechoslovakia in World War II, and then what happened to them once the Gestapo went after them. That's a resistance that has some nerve. These people are just a bunch of lightweights, narcissists, use whatever expression you want, but just disgraceful. And I suspect that when the person's identity does get revealed, that they're probably fairly low level.
Well, we're one day closer to it, just so everybody knows, because we live in a day and age where if you think you can hide that stuff, you're a fool. All right, sir. Thank you very much for the discussion today. Always enjoy it. Travel safe. Enjoy Australia, and we'll talk to you down the road.
Okay. Thanks very much.
You bet. That is the one and only Grant Newsham here on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio. You know what? Grant is I thoroughly enjoy having him on the program. Absolutely, positively, thoroughly enjoy having him on the program. So we'll take a quick break. Gunnar joins us next, right here on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Yeah, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs at allmarineradio.com. And I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.